This is the Mobile Tech Podcast, brought to you by worldpodcasts.com. Now here's your host, Tech Girl Miriam Joie.
Hi, and welcome to the Mobile Tech Podcast. I'm your host, Miriam Joie, and today is Tuesday, June 27th, and I have a really awesome guest on the show today, Joshua Vergara. Hi, Josh. How's it going?
I'm doing all right. Hey, how's it going? Yeah, you're always so sweet whenever you introduce me.
Aww.
On your show.
Well, you know, it's the least I can do. I was going to say, I didn't mention, obviously, for those of you who don't know, Josh works for Android Authority and does all kinds of great video work over there and reviews. And we'll let you plug yourself at the end. I know you also have your own YouTube channel, so we'll talk about that maybe.
Sure.
Phones. There's not too much new phone news this week, but I know you've played with a lot of the phones we've discussed on previous episodes. And I kind of want to have your thoughts on some of them. And I know you want to talk about wearables, and I know you want to talk about a phone that I don't have, which is a Sony phone. But let's start with, I think, the phone that a lot of people are still super excited about that was finally released last week, and that's the OnePlus 5.
Yep, the phone of the moment.
What are your thoughts on this one?
So I did not do the review at Android Authority, but I did do a number of comparisons with it, and I actually have it right over here. I really do like the phone a lot, to be honest. And I think that we have finally a phone that does Zoom capability pretty well, that can be widely distributed. Because I remember the Xiaomi Mi 6 was actually the first Android phone to have that Zoom capability. And while it was pretty well done, it was not really that... It's a phone that you're not going to get in the West. Let's put it that way first.
Sure, yeah.
There's a reason why it stays in China. But with the OnePlus 5, I really think that there's a lot of sort of backlash about the design of the phone and the fact, or I won't say fact, but the opinion, I should say, that it looks so much like an iPhone 7 or whatever the case may be. I actually don't see that a whole lot.
My
one thing here is, as far as those antenna lines go, I understand it looks a lot like the iPhone 7 Plus. But if that's the best place to put the antenna lines, then who are we to complain?
Yeah, I think not only that, but if you look at the phone from the front and you look at it side by side at OnePlus 3 or 3T, it's very clearly a OnePlus design. And
absolutely.
And it's just corner radii, I guess, for the angle of the corners, and also the fact that the top and bottom edges aren't actually flat, they're slightly rounded. And I mean, it basically, to me, yes, in photos it can kind of look like an iPhone 7 Plus, but once you touch it and once you see it in person, that fear should be gone. I mean, I suppose that if you're just holding the phone and having a phone call in the streets, people might think you're using an iPhone. But that's what the wonderful OnePlus cases are for, right? The bamboo, the rosewood. Actually, no bamboo this time. At least I didn't get a bamboo one. I got a rosewood, I got an ebony one, and I got like the slate and like all these other non-wood ones. I like the wood ones, so...
Yeah, the wood ones are definitely good. They kind of doubled back on the bamboo, though. I kind of missed that.
Yeah, why did they not do bamboo? I mean, that was a really strong protection, too. Like, on the previous phones, I used it a lot. But, I mean, what I'm saying is that if you look at it from the front, it's unmistakably a OnePlus. And if you look at it from the back, once you hold it, because the edges on the back are kind of like chamfered a little bit, like there's like a bit of a roundness to the sides. That I think an iPhone doesn't have at all, because the iPhone is just like this perfectly flat back, really, with these, you know, the same roundness on top and bottom and sides. And I think that once you hold it in your hand, it feels so different than an iPhone. And then if you use one of those cases, I think you will definitely stand out of the crowd. People are not going to say this is an iPhone 7 Plus with a bamboo case or whatever, an ebony or rosewood case. I think, to me, anyone who knows their phones are going to say, oh, this is a OnePlus 5.
You know what I really love about this, though, is that, actually, on the design front, there's one thing that I did want to mention.
Sure.
The camera optic package, you know, you got those two lenses there. Yes, that positioning will make people think about the iPhone, but one thing I kept thinking was the OnePlus 3 or the 3T or whatever the case may be, I liked where that camera was. It would have been great if they just added the extra lens to that location.
I agree. I think that the OnePlus 3 and 3T was the most iconically OnePlus design since the OnePlus One, right? I mean,
yeah,
the absolutely. OnePlus One really had a unique kind of vibe, unless you count the Oppos. And again, the Oppo, what was it? The 6 something that the OnePlus One came out of? I can't remember.
I think it was the Find 5.
Find 5 or 7. Maybe you're right. I don't remember. Look it up. We talked about it last week.
It was a while ago.
Yeah, but the point is this: there's the Oppo R11, which is kind of the elephant in the room here that is... clearly, the optics package is identical. But if you look at the R11, there are some differences. The flash is positioned in the same place. But it's clear that there's economies of scale at play here that, you know, the same parent company owns Oppo and OnePlus, and that they decided, let's get some commonality between these two devices so that we can save money. And ultimately, this is an important thing for OnePlus is, you know, they're known for making affordable flagships, and the prices keep creeping up on all flagships and clearly on the OnePlus 5. And I think you brought up design. I think a lot of moaning and groaning, as I'm hearing, is pricing. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I feel like some users get a little, okay, there are a lot of users out there who could really use a device like this at a lower price point. Like, everyone's always going to want that. But I also think that we've gotten just a little bit spoiled.
Right? I mean, I think so.
Yeah, because especially with like the OnePlus One, that was the case with the 349, if I'm remembering my price points correctly. But with a phone like this, you know, we have premium materials and also premium features all over the place. While the screen could be one of those points of contention, I still think that at its price, it's still less than the S8 outright. It's still less than the G6 outright.
It's like 200.
I don't know.
Less than
I think everyone
those,
just
you know. I mean, it's.
Yeah, exactly.
Still a big save. And that's why I'm like, okay, I get it, though. I mean, people who have a set price, right, in mind, for them, maybe it has crossed a barrier, right, that is making it tough to reach, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that's why we're hearing the moaning and groaning. But I think that ultimately, if you compare it to the fact that, you know, all the flagships have gone up in price, I think the G6 is still pretty reasonably priced, but Pixels are expensive. The Galaxy S8 is pretty quite expensive. You know, there's talks of the Note 8 being $1,000.
I was just about to bring that up.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's another rumor of the week. And that's, I wouldn't be surprised. Like, guys, like, I want to rewind time. You probably were in diapers back then. Not you, Josh, but some of the listeners. But when I bought my N95 from Nokia in 2007, it cost me $1,200 unlocked, US.
Wow.
So, you know, look, it's not that crazy. Like, we did go down in price for a while, down to the $500-$600 range for flagships. But that was a while ago, if you think about it. And now, you know, the last few years, it's been creeping up. But if you look at what we're getting for our money, our phones are so much better. Like, you can pick almost any Android phone today that's a flagship and walk away with a guaranteed great experience. You couldn't say that not very long ago. That wasn't always the case. You're going to say a lot of it has to do with software, but I disagree. Like, look at all these phones now. Like, the Galaxy S5 is only, 3 years old now? And that was a piece of turd plastic, right? Like, you can't even conceive of making a flagship phone that's not metal and glass today.
That's true. Yeah, the S5 was like the last of its kind in a way, especially for the flagship game. You're absolutely right.
LG maybe held out a little bit longer with the G4, but we could excuse it because it had these leather backs that were awesome. But I mean, it's not that long ago that flagships were plastic, and you know that I used to beat this to death when it was already dead as an argument that we should have metal and glass phones, you know? And so things are evolving, and you know, maybe it sucks that you have to pay more money, but at the same time, you know, our phones are fast and they can do so much more than they did just 2 years ago. You remember when fingerprint readers weren't even on flagships? It's not that long ago. The G4 didn't have a fingerprint reader. The Nexus 6 is the most recent Google device without a fingerprint reader. So
true, yeah.
Now I've got a Moto E4 in my pocket that has a fingerprint reader and costs $70, and we're going to talk about that in a minute.
And we take it for granted. I mean, we're going to mention talk about the Xperia in a little bit that doesn't have the fingerprint reader in the West, at least, which is incredibly frustrating. Yeah, it's really, really frustrating. And but going back to the OnePlus 5, there is one feature that I really enjoy on it, and it's kind of a niche thing, because I'm a Kindle reader. Do you use that reading mode a lot?
I don't, but I think it's a great idea. I like it so much better than the alternatives that we're seeing on a lot of Android phones where you got that night mode that is all yellowish. I much prefer going black and white if I have a choice, frankly.
Yeah, yeah. And it actually makes the phone almost feel like a mini Kindle, which I thought was really odd because, I mean, the Kindles are not that big. So I usually have one on me, especially when I travel and all that. But having the OnePlus 5 as a daily phone, if I wanted to catch up on some reading or just sort of, you know, note back to some of the books that I have, it's actually really nice. It's a good feature to have, and I think it should kind of be a part of a lot of phones in the future because we do so much reading on these phones and it messes with our eyes.
Sure, especially if you're trying to go to sleep at night with that blue light. I mean, I'm used to it, but a lot of people have struggling with it, you know, and I think it was a smart thing, and it's just a software thing. Any phone could do this, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So we've talked about the design and the pricing, and I'm not a big benchmark person, but I know there's been a lot of brouhaha around cheating on benchmarks. And I frankly don't understand why you'd even want to do that as a manufacturer. Like, so I kind of like, I've stuck my head in the sand about this because I like the phone so much. But this to me, you know, shows that there's a problem with phone manufacturers still, primarily out of China, around and Taiwan, because HTC's done it too, around benchmarks and around cheating. You know, like, to me, if your company is built on a culture where cheating is acceptable, how can I trust that your company is going to be honest? And I'm really kind of annoyed with that. And that's kind of why I'm sticking my head in the sand, because I'm like, no, it's not so much that they did the cheating, Joshua. It's just that when I, have you read Pete Lau's interview by this Indian newspaper or Indian blog about where they address all these issues, the price, the design. And some of the answers he gave, I think, are really great. Like he said, you know, I'm totally on in agreement with their point of view. It's like, so what? Like, we made a phone that we think is still very much a OnePlus, and yes, there are some similarities to the iPhone 7 Plus. So what, right? Pricing, again, I think I can completely defend as well. I see that, you know, you're getting a Snapdragon 835 with 8 gigs of RAM on this phone. Like, come on, you know. But I do have to say, his answer about the cheating on the benchmark thing was very much the kind of answer that, you know, Kyle Pei gave when we talked about the lacking NFC on the OnePlus 2, right? It's like, please, you're totally BSing us, and we know you're BSing us. Stop it.
Well, there's a certain measure to... Okay, so I don't remember who exactly told me their perspective on this. So I'm kind of biting somebody else's way of explaining this. But, you know, I apologize for that. I can't even remember who it was. But someone on the team. But the way that I think about it now is because we're always assuming that these benchmark apps are standardized, you know, and the funny part is all these benchmark apps are also completely free. So if there was like a company or like a committee out there that actually tried to standardize the benchmarking process, I could see how cheating kind of works there. But the benchmarking applications are very similar to the way that they measure a phone is very similar to the way that a game requires the power out of a phone. And when the Snapdragon or whatever the processor might be kind of goes into overdrive, it's like overclocking a processor or overclocking a video card in a computer. And it's something that, I mean, I guess most users never really need to know about or ever really care, to be honest. It's really only the people who want that extra power that know that that can be done. And if OnePlus is doing that, they're not necessarily, I don't know. I'm on the fence about it as well. I don't think they're doing it to game the system, but they put that in place to make sure that performance during high powered things like games actually happen. It just so happens that it also occurs during the benchmarking applications.
Right. And you know what? That might very well be, and that's totally cool. It's just, I feel that the answers are not like, if I, you know, as a person who does PR as well, I'm like, come on, like, you got to deal with this in a different way than being so nonchalant about it. That's not
fair.
Like, you know, you need to, you're a small player that people really love. And I certainly love OnePlus. And I'm really glad they exist as a competitor out there, kind of, because they throw a wrench in everything all the time in a really, really good way. But I want them to be more honest and more upfront with dealing with this stuff. And it's kind of bugging me that, you know, it's not quite there yet. It's like, we never got a satisfactory answer for lack of NFC on the OnePlus 2. And you're going to say, who cares? That's three generations ago. And I'm like, yeah, but that's exactly the problem, that they've improved a lot in a lot of way they address their issues. But I still think that at the core, they have this very like kind of meh, you know, perspective on things. And I don't like working with companies that have a meh perspective on things. I want to work with companies that, you know, take responsibility and fix things and actually like explain and actually go ahead and do their thing. And that's kind of why I, especially for a company like OnePlus, where all the users are so passionate, I feel that they're missing an opportunity to really like answer this properly, you know?
Yeah, I agree with you there. And I also think it's kind of funny and slightly ironic, you know, just going meta here, that, you know, we both do really enjoy OnePlus, and in a way we really like the company, we like what they do. But I feel like a lot of the people who really are super fans of the company love it because of that meh attitude.
Well, in some ways it's kind of fun, right? But when it starts affecting your image, I think that's something they should, you know, kind of like consider. And I think, to me,
oh, you're absolutely right.
It's like, you know, we still haven't had a satisfactory answer as to why there's no OIS on the camera. Right?
True.
And so, so I want to talk about the camera. Let's segue into that, because, you know, we could go on and on about, I really don't put it, like, I just want to make it clear. I have no issues with this benchmark crap. Like, to me, benchmarks don't matter. I don't play games on my phones. Like, so what? They overclock it when they run games and it affects benchmarks. That's probably what you said is probably the case, which I probably agree to. But when somebody you know, claims you're cheating, you should deal with it in a PR way that's better than what they're dealing with. At the same time, yeah, it's no big deal. And I'm not really upset about myself. I'm just more upset about their reaction and their kind of like shrugginess about the whole thing. Don't shrug, just deal, okay? And then, but the camera is an interesting thing on the OnePlus 5. I think it's pretty good, but at the same time, it's not as good as it could be, right?
I believe so as well, but I don't know, the sort of pitfalls that these cameras have, especially, I mean, obviously low light is always going to be an issue, but I think that I'm honestly happy that we have a good portrait mode in Android right now.
Do you feel it's good though? I don't feel it's that good.
Really? It provides a little bit of a different aesthetic than what we're used to with like fixed focal lengths and, you know, the software stuff, you know. And I know that depth of field effects have been used on other phones before, but they were terrible on those phones. The HTC One M8 comes to mind.
Oh yeah, that's 4 years ago, right? Come on.
Well, fair. Yeah, that's fair. But it's nice to see that we actually have proper depth of field effects and we're actually using focal length to get that. And right. It's just sort of logistically, or rather on a technical level, I should say, on a technical level, that makes that's the way it works. And I love that phone companies are kind of cluing into that.
I agree. I think I'm happy that they tried to do a dual lens phone and that the results overall are very good. My concern is this: the iPhone 7 Plus does a much better job at portrait mode. If you look at the edges, they're much better defined. Okay. I had a lot of issues with edge detection on my photos with the OnePlus 5. Now, I've received two software updates since my initial review, so it could have improved. I just haven't really tested it. The other thing is, honestly, the Huawei P10 and P10 Plus, in my opinion, do a much better job at camera depth portrait mode.
Okay.
And I think you should try it out and see for yourself. So it's not, you know, it's not so clear cut. And at the and then to me, honestly, it's a hard one, because I think the G6 the really super wide angle and regular camera versus a regular camera and a super narrow angle telephoto. You know, to me, the G6 package is a better package for imaging.
I was just about to ask what you would prefer, because I was my question was going to be, do you zoom? Do you even zoom a lot?
I don't. I have to admit that with the P10 and P10 Plus and the OnePlus 5, because I know I can losslessly zoom up to 2x, mm-hmm. right? Because on the P10 Plus, they have some sort of software algorithm that really uses those large sensors that they have and the monochrome and color and combine them in clever ways to basically give you essentially lossless up to 2x. Beyond that, you start losing resolution.
Yes.
And OnePlus 5 does this optically, and of course the iPhone does it optically because they actually have a telephoto lens. Yes, now I'm using the zoom. I am, because I know it's not going to mess with my photos. But at the same time, I would rather have that super wide angle that the G6 V20 have.
Yeah, it's almost more. It's more fun.
It's more fun, and it's actually more practical, I think, in most scenarios. I can always get closer from my subject, usually, but it's really hard to pull back, right? When you're in a small room and you want to capture everything. Mm-hmm. So to me, the G6 setup is a better setup. And frankly, I would even go beyond that and say that the Huawei setup with a monochrome and color lens is even a better setup overall, because it, you know, there's some issues with the P10. I think that the low light could still be better, but their Leica lenses are so high quality, and this monochrome. Yeah, exactly. The monochrome versus color concept to me is a much better approach to doing dual camera. So it's kind of interesting that we're having this conversation, that there's basically three ways of doing dual cameras that we're seeing out there right now. Mm-hmm. There were four in the past, because some people did dual identical cameras, like the Honor 6, which was the first dual camera phone from Huawei a while mm-hmm. back. But really right now, there's three schools of thought. There's a OnePlus iPhone school, which is a telephoto and a regular. There's the LG school, which is a regular and a wide angle. And then there is the Huawei approach, which is the monochrome and color sensor. And others are using the monochrome and color. Who was it that did that too?
I have, it's on the tip of my tongue as
well.
Yeah,
you too, right? Like, I can't really remember who it is specifically, but it did happen recently.
Yeah, I also think it's pretty great that you just brought up that somebody else was doing the monochrome stuff. That's actually a really good point to make, which kind of puts me in the camp of, I give LG a lot of credit.
Essential.
Oh, the Essential's doing it. There you go. Yeah, I give LG a lot of credit, because they have their lane, and I think it's wonderful that they have their lane with the wide-angle lens. Meanwhile, everybody else is trying to bite on the iPhone method of zoom and all that, and the monochrome sensor, like you just said, the Essential is going to be doing that too. So, like, I don't know. This conversation makes me really respect LG more all of a sudden.
Well, to me, what really blows my mind about the G6 today still is that it uses very small pixels, very much like the OnePlus 5, you know, 1.1 micron, 1.13, mm-hmm. I think, micron. And yet it has the best low light noise reduction performance of any small pixel phone in the entire universe. Like, mm-hmm. it can compete with a large pixel XL phones, or a large pixel phones like the Galaxy S8, no problem in low light. Yet it's using pixels that are much, much smaller in that sensor. Nobody else has pulled that off yet. That's one of the areas where I think the OnePlus 5 falls apart in noise reduction and low light, especially on that zoom lens, which is only an f/2.6 instead of the f/1.7. And this brings us back to my really big vexation about the whole thing, is the lack of OIS, at least on the primary lens. Like, iPhone still has OIS on the non-telephoto lens, and I wish that OnePlus had done that, because, you know, you can now do long exposures handheld in manual mode and get some really cool kind of light trailing effects without using a tripod, which you can do with the G6, you can do with the Galaxy S8, you can do with any phone that has OIS. And I feel the same way about the Pixel. The Pixel is amazing in low light, but damn, the fact that I can't actually do long exposures with my own hands because there's no OIS really bugs me.
That's a very specific situation. I think you're one of the few people that I know who actually actively look for that particular situation, which I think is awesome.
Well, it's because I don't like to carry gear around for photography. You know, it's like you're you go with your mom to like, you know, I don't know, like Alcatraz Island for the evening, and you want to take some cool photos. If you have to bring a little gorilla pod on top of that so you can put the phone down, it becomes like, you know, like I get it. Like you can do that and it certainly replaces the OIS really well, but I find it annoying. It's like, I don't want to have to do that. And honestly, I think that you can see in the Pixel, like I try, you know, I don't know. Have you ever flown on the Boeings that have the starry light ceiling?
Actually, no.
So there's a bunch of newer Boeing airplanes, I think the 777, 787, 747, the newer ones, that depending on what cabin configuration you're in, you think you have to be in business or first for this. But in some of the cabin configuration, when they go into like, you know, this everybody go to sleep mode now, they have this really cool, the ceiling turns into a starry sky. Oh. And they have fiber optic little holes with little stars lit through this, and they use blue purple LEDs to give you this kind of night sky. It's really cool. So last time I was flying back from Taiwan, you know, you and I were both at Computex.
Indeed.
And I flew back and with EVA Air on the 777 in business class, and they had this, and I was like, oh, I gotta take a photo of that. And I was like, let's take a photo with my Pixel. And we were still taking off, so there's a little bit of turbulence, like the plane is moving a little bit, but I'm like, I'm bracing myself, and I'm like, this is not going to be an issue. The Pixel could not nail a photo that was non-blurry at all. Like, it just couldn't. I tried so many times, so I finally pulled out the Galaxy S8, and I just nailed the shot instantly. And that's what I'm talking about. Like, OIS, right there. That's it. That's the reason you have it. It's that occasional case scenario where you can't nail something. Like, I think actually a lot of situations where you're in a moving vehicle at low light and you're trying to take a photo of the outside and your vehicle is moving relative to the outside is where you know, even if you brace on a tripod, you're screwed, right? Because your vehicle is moving.
Yeah.
So what do you do? And so you're going to say, well, you know, it's a $500 flagship and they had to cut corners somewhere, and they already did on the 1080p display and they already did on the non-waterproofing. So I don't know. Oh, come on, put OIS on the main camera and call it a day. You know, that would have, for me, that would have been perfect. That and waterproofing really are the two things that I'm missing.
Yeah, I think I agree as well. I mean, I believe the Xiaomi Mi 6 with its dual lens setup, especially with that zoom, they had the OIS on the regular lens.
Right.
It wasn't on the zoom. Now, the thing that I hated about that phone was that I couldn't use the zoom lens while recording video, which kind of really breaks my vlogging lifestyle.
You can do that on the OnePlus 5, so that's cool.
Yes, you can. Yeah, exactly. So I think they did a good job with it, to be honest.
Look, it's really good for the money, guys. I mean, we're bitching and we're being like super detailed here, but the takeaway here is it's just, I want Josh's opinion because he's used it and it's still a fresh phone and we still have a lot to say about this phone. But the reality is that if you're looking at buying an unlocked flagship and you're in one of the GSM networks in the world and you want to save a bit of money, you cannot go wrong with OnePlus 5.
Yeah, you really can't.
You just cannot.
They've done a good job of, I don't know, that the hype is still there. I mean, I hate that the word hype is thrown around so much, especially around the time of a OnePlus launch. But you know what? Like, maybe they did. There's no way of truly measuring whether or not the hype was met with the OnePlus phone. But that's the reason why reviewers like us exist. So for us to say that it is a solid phone, and you know what? I would be able to use it on. I would use it on the daily if I wasn't so in love with what I actually use on the daily,
which is
the BlackBerry Q1.
Oh my God, you're still using it? Your daily? Oh my God, let's talk about that in a second.
I love this thing so much.
So, I mean, wrapping up the OnePlus 5, I think realistically, you can't go wrong. It's a great phone. You know, the questions you have to ask yourself is, does it fall in my budget? If you can't afford one of the big flagships, but you can afford the OnePlus 5, absolutely a no-brainer to go for it. If you need the waterproofing and that's really important to you, then obviously think twice about the OnePlus 5 because, you know, there's some basic water resistance built in like most phones today, but it's not officially certified, which means that, you know, be very careful if you drop it in a sink while shaving in the morning or something. And then the OIS is really going to be a minor issue for most of you, but be aware that it is less because of the small pixels and, you know, the lack of expertise that OnePlus has in image processing, you're not going to get the same level of low light performance as, say, a G6 that has tiny pixels. But then again, the G6 also has OIS. So just be aware that low light is not quite up to par with the best of the best today, but it is better than the OnePlus 3T and OnePlus 3. It is better than a lot of phones from 2016. Flagships included.
Oh, absolutely. It gets the fundamentals down so well. And for the vast majority of people out there, it's just going to be a solid phone.
I know.
Yeah.
And of course, headphone jack, which to me is like a big vexing thing when they remove it. And then, you know, Snapdragon 835. I don't honestly think you should spend the money on the 8 gig version, but if you want to go nuts and, you know, tell your friend that has an old laptop that you have more RAM in your phone than he does, or she does, this is the phone to have. No micro SD is a minor thing. If you need storage, make sure you get the bigger phone. But that's really it. You just can't go wrong with this phone. And it feels so good in hand, and it's so thin. You know, battery life is fine. It's not phenomenal, but it's perfectly usable. I think they hit a lot of the check boxes, like, and nailed a lot of stuff.
We're going to revisit this at some point, but when the Essential phone comes out, I already know what my buzz, like clickbaity title is going to be.
Oh, yeah? Do you want to share, or is it secret?
No, it's not secret at all. I just think that, you know, even if you look at the spec sheets right now, whatever is published at this very moment about the Essential phone, the OnePlus 5 is more essential than the Essential, because... like, it comes down to semantics, obviously. Like, what is essential to you?
Right.
And I don't think that a modular 360 camera really counts as essential.
Oh, my God. Don't even get me started on this camera. Like, I don't know who it was we talked about this, but the camera looks so cheap compared to the phone. Like, in terms of, like, the design, the look and feel of it. I haven't touched it, so I can say feel, but the look of it. I'm like, you made this absolutely amazing titanium and ceramic phone, and then you put this plastic wart of a 360 camera that looks like ass on it. Like, please. What were you thinking, guys?
There's so much about that phone that feels superfluous to me. And, you know, I get it. You know, you have to call it essential and everyone's going to, like, talk about it and stuff. But, like, you know, coming from somebody who is a student of communication, like, if you're going to use a word like essential, like, you better make a phone that is literally essential. But it seems like so many things on there are just either bloaty or it's superfluous. Like, it's too much.
Well, it is Andy Rubin's.
Meanwhile, the OnePlus 5, it's exactly what it needs to be.
Andy Rubin's company, and, you know, he is... an interesting and an odd character. I don't know if you ever got a chance to talk to him back in the Android days, but
I did not.
I like what he does a lot. I'm a big fan. But I do have to say that, you know, he thinks in a different... it's like Elon Musk. He's like in a different universe. Like, you know,
fair.
Maybe his body's occupied by an alien. Who knows? You know, but they're not like... these people are so smart. It's like it's a different universe. And I don't think, you know, I never took the essential on its... like the wording essential for this phone as a, like, on the, literally, you know, in any way. Like, I think they just thought it was a cool name.
Yeah.
And
I agree.
And I think what they're trying to say is they want to get back to the essentials. And what they mean by that is like a pure Android experience in a really beautiful vessel, not so much as a, you know, Moto E4. That's an essential phone in the pure literal sense. That phone, I honestly think, this is what blows me away, and we talk about this in a bit more depth after you talk about the Sony, but that E4 is blowing my mind, because I'm like, I could live with that phone. This is the first sub-$100 phone where I'm like, yeah, do I really need more?
Okay.
And it's
I
mean, I thought that I would never say that about an E-series, but the G like the G phones from Moto have always been like, yeah, if it's the apocalypse and I need a phone... And all I can afford, you know, in the black market is a G5 Plus, I'll be absolutely perfectly served. Now, I wouldn't say absolutely perfectly with the E4, but I would say, like, damn, it's close. But let's talk about the XZ
Premium, yes.
Premium.
Oh, a phone that I've gotten very familiar with over the last
number of
weeks.
It's so big.
It's a big phone.
It has a small display and a lot of bezel.
Well, okay, so you do have the front-facing speakers on it, and the one thing I will say, though, is even though it is a larger phone, it's not that hard to handle. Like, I mean, reaching on the screen, I mean, that's always going to be a thing. But you know, it sits very squarely because the top and bottom are incredibly flat, while the sides are nice and rounded, so you can grip the hell out of it, so you're not going to drop it at all. So it's, I don't know, I'm a big proponent of like a pop socket on a phone, and unfortunately the glass on the back of the XZ Premium doesn't take to a pop socket very well, which is a big bummer, but I found myself not really missing it too much because I was able to balance it pretty well. So I don't know, there's a certain give and take on it, and I think that having, you know, all these curves on all these phones, like I'm holding the OnePlus 5 right now, but like the all these curves and everything just kind of make it so that the phone can just be like whoop. But when we have flatness on a phone, it makes a lot of sense, and I feel like designers need to sort of go back to the drawing board and kind of just revisit that. But yeah, it's a big phone, but
I've always liked the industrial design of the Sonys. I'll be honest, I like the square phones a lot. But I just, the XZ Premium just never, from day one, from like right at Mobile Congress, I'm like, I don't like this phone, it's ugly. Like immediately I was like, seriously, like Sony, you've done so much better in the past. And I don't know what it is. I think it's part of it is the shininess and the fingerprint magnetiness and then the bezel. And then you say there's no fingerprint reader, but I didn't even think that was a consideration on a flagship. Is it not integrated into the power button on the side like all the Sonys always have?
It is everywhere but in the States. And there are a lot of different stories. There are a lot of different stories as to why. I shouldn't be quoted on this, but if I remember correctly, it's sort of like a patent law or something like that, or a licensing law that Sony doesn't have in the West. And by West, I mean the States for sure. I don't know if it's the case.
So you
in
know
Canada.
What that means, Joshua? It means that the phone has the hardware and it's disabled in software because there's no way they're going to make a different version. And so somebody needs to flash the Asian, like Taiwan or like one of the English savvy Asian country language packs to the phone and see what happens because I bet
you
it works.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And when I use the phone in Taipei, because I did get to play with a phone there, someone else had their unit, and I was like, oh, this one has a fingerprint reader. It works so well. And the thing is, like, Sony, it's a great idea, putting that big power button on the side. You press it, it's already reading your fingerprint. It just unlocks. It doesn't even show you the lock screen. It just goes straight into the interface. I think that's a brilliant idea, and it's such a small thing in the grand scheme of things, but like, you know, the quality of life, it's the little things about a phone that make it great, like that camera button. Ooh, I can't say enough good things about having
I love camera buttons.
Camera button.
Look,
yeah.
I've given up on arguing that point. It's like, you know, for a long time I argued about camera lens protection back in the day of like the N95 and stuff. At least the original N95 had a little plastic shutter that you could cover the camera lens with so that if you put it down the wrong way, you didn't scratch the lens. Now, back then, they also did not have sapphire covering on the lenses, but the point is I gave up on that eventually because it became very, very clear that people want thin phones and they're not going to add a layer of plastic on top like to protect the glass. So I've given up on that and I've kind of given up on the camera button, but I have to admit a good double detent camera key is a godsend. If you're a photographer and you're used to it on a real camera, having it on a phone, for me, the biggest thing is the ability to half press with focus on center, right? And then once I've locked exposure and focus on whatever subject, being able to reframe and take the photo, right? But that's exactly what you do with a normal camera all the time.
Exactly.
And like, that's such a natural motion if you're a photographer. Like, I don't know. I just wish more phones had it. It's such a simple thing. And you're going to say, well, you know, the volume button can be programmed. It's not the same. You don't have dual detent. Come on.
Yeah, it's not the same. And at the same time, the volume buttons are usually pretty close to the actual camera optics. So every now and then you're going to get a finger in your photo. Like, so there's that. And honestly, like having that button just dedicated to it, it kind of eliminates the need to press the power button twice. You just hold that button and it goes straight to the camera. You can get certain angles better when you have a camera button like that. And really, I've always been a proponent of extra inputs on phones. Like going back to the OnePlus 5, just for a second, the alert slider, great idea. It allows for just an easy tactile way of knowing that you did something.
Oh, I love the alert slider. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, well, and then on a BlackBerry, in my case with the key one, like when I actually don't use the app drawer anymore because I've already mapped all of my shortcuts to the keyboard, so I know exactly what to do to get to where I need to be, and I know I'm going to get there because there's a click and there's an actual tactile feel. And the same thing goes for the camera. I know that I open the camera. Like if I'm looking at, I remember I went to a Mexican restaurant down in San Diego, and I really wanted to like record the experience for my Instagram stories, but I used the regular camera, and like, I don't know, instead of having to like unlock the phone, go to the camera app, or even press the power button twice, it was just nice that I already had my finger on the dedicated camera button. And when I saw that something was about to happen, I just held down. I felt that little vibration telling me that it was open. And then I just brought it up, hit the button, got the picture just like that. That is what that button is for. And it's
absolutely
great.
So yeah. Tell us more about the ZX. XZ, XZ? Oh,
XZ
God,
premium,
I'll never get it right. XZ, XZ blah, whatever it is. Special.
Yeah, the XZ Premium.
Premium.
I
mean, other than, okay, so it's got no fingerprint reader in the US, no dedicated camera button. It's super shiny and slab looking. How does it distinguish itself from, like, why would you buy that over Galaxy S8 or, you know, one of the current, you know, super expensive, awesome 835 flagships?
Well, I can hear, I can already feel all of the Sony love, because Sony has such a loyal
true
fan base, you know, and they're just always, and I get it actually, like, because it's easy to get burned out on Sony phones because they come out so often, and I can get why, you know, some reviewers might be like, oh, another Sony. And the thing that I think what made this phone so fun to review, at least for me, is that it's been a while since I've used an Xperia. Lon has been taking care of all the Xperias for the last like year and a half. And for this one, he was like, Josh, you want to try this one? Because, you know, it's another Xperia. You have a fresher perspective. And I was like, yeah, you know what? I'd be very down. And there are a lot of people who have the previous XZ or even the Z5 Premium. And, you know, they know what Sony's all about. So if there's anybody that hasn't used a Sony in quite a while, let's say, the Premium is actually a good place to come back because they've tried really hard with this phone. Now, granted, the software is an issue, fingerprint reader and all that. And actually, the software, because it's customized the way that it is to turn off the fingerprint reader, you can't use Android Pay.
I was gonna say, right? You can't use Android Pay, so that sucks.
Yeah, so it's a crapshoot, right? And on the back of the phone, you have a clear NFC marking, and you're like, well, that's useless now. But on the other hand, what you have is a 4K display on here, and the Z5 Premium had a 4K display, but it would only display native 4K content if it detected it was being used. Now, in this case, the screen is always pumping out that 4K resolution. And yes, it's upscaling 1080 stuff, it's upscaling the software, but for all intents and purposes, you are using all of the pixels are being used. And it makes for an incredibly sharp display. And
I bet.
It's not really something that would change most people's daily usage of the phone. Like, they're not going to use it and be like, oh, well, now I can't go to my S8 because it's not as pixel dense. No, of course not. But it's really nice to have, and I really enjoyed it the most when I was playing video games on the phone because it made for a very sharp game experience. I will say, though, I did not really watch... I couldn't watch a lot of 4K content because I don't think any of my internet connections are good enough to watch 4K content. Like, there's always going to be a stutter at some point. Like, it has to buffer again. So that was frustrating, but it's possible, and it looks great.
It's a phone from the future.
A little bit.
Yeah.
It's a content issue, though, because there's not a lot of 4K content out there.
No.
Not enough, at least.
Well, the idea is you create your own, right?
Fair. And you can with the phone because it's 4K camera.
You need to watch all of Marquez's videos because they're all 4K or 8K or whatever, 16K he's using now.
Yeah, he starts at 8, I think, and then he...
I think, yeah, it's amazing. Tell us about the camera on this. I mean, Sony obviously has had a lot of, you know, good cameras, at least on paper, in their phones for a long time because they use their own sensors and stuff. But the results are never that great to me, at least.
They're not exceptional. I'll say that, but they're still more than way more than adequate. I think that people, like we've always said before. I'm sure we said this on the last podcast that I was here with you, Miriam. picture quality is always sort of a relative term because people always want different things from their photos.
Right.
And that's why the iPhones and the Galaxies of the world get a lot of praise because they bump up the colors and all that. But for the Xperia, now, no OIS either, so that's an issue, especially in low light.
I don't understand why there hasn't been a single phone from Sony since the Z series, I guess, came out. Mm-hmm. That has OIS. It's like they sell OIS sensors to everyone else.
Yeah, they do. And
I don't get it. It's like they almost purposely cripple their devices so that, oh, well, you know, we can't sell our, we have to sell our OIS sensors to someone. We're not going to use them ourselves.
Yeah. Well, it might be a cost thing. You know, I don't really like speculating on that kind of stuff because we really don't know. And
it's
just a bummer. It's a 19 megapixel, technically. Better way to put it. 13 on the front, which makes for pretty good selfies. But I mean, I don't take selfies too often anyway. But for the 19 megapixel camera, I think the marquee feature of this is definitely the super slow motion capture. And now it's not a new thing, but it's here on the XE Premium. You get 960 frame per second at 720p video. And
cool.
It's pretty incredible. They have kind of an intuitive way of doing it also. You start recording a 720p video, and then while you're recording, that way you have the footage anyway, while you're recording, you hit a button in order to trigger the 960 frame per second capture. And it's up to you to know when to hit that button, which is not always the easiest thing. But yeah, it works pretty damn well. But the problem is that since it has to have such a high shutter speed, if you're using it in anything but broad daylight, it's gonna look like a smudgy mess. So
all right.
Yeah, so there's just no using it indoors. Like there's a clip in my review that just came out today, actually. There's a clip in my review of me and my friend in a pizza joint in Brooklyn, New York, and one of the guys throws the dough at the other person, and you can see the dough because it's a light colored thing, but everything else is just smudged out.
Oh, that sucks. But I mean, it's cool. That 960 frames per second. Wow.
Mm-hmm. You can do 120 at 1080. So you can still get that sort of more conventional slow motion, which is actually the original way of doing it. You do 120 or, you know, God willing, depending on what camera you have, you can do 240.
Right, 240.
At native resolutions. But otherwise, I actually think the camera's really good. I do think that it slightly overexposes in bright situations. I think it's because it's a little bit too excited. But
it's like a puppy.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, good lighting. And then it just kind of like goes a little too far. The superior auto, though, I have to say, for anybody that
has
really
been good for a long time on Sony phones. It's exactly really, and you can tell they pulled that right out of like the RX100 and the NEX series. Mm-hmm. I know they're not called NEXs anymore. They're Alpha something now, the E series APS-C cameras. But I'm old school. I still call them NEXs. They definitely pulled that out of there because I have like a really old NEX and it has like a, they don't call it superior auto, but something similar. Mm-hmm. And I'm always blown away at its choices. Like it's really on top of it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's one of those intangibles that I think a lot of smartphone shutter bugs don't really realize is happening because, you know, usually people just, you know, turn on their S7 or whatever the case may be and just tap on the part that they want to look good and then it blows out the rest of the photo. And like they don't quite understand why that's happening. They just kind of complain about the pictures being bad, but you know, there's some tweaking involved. Sony, on the other hand, they've kind of taken the guesswork out of it. Even if you tap on a dark area and it blows out the rest of the photo, it's like, oh snap, we better tone it down, and it does.
Nice.
And it's great. I absolutely adore that. I had never felt the need to use manual unless I wanted to force HDR, so right. That was really the only time that I needed to do that. My one gripe about the camera, though, is that you have to swipe and go through a couple of different menus just to reach 4K video, because it's a mode. It's not a setting, it's a mode.
Oh.
Why?
How odd. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's this the is the thing about Sony phones. It's like weird, weird UI things all over the place, in my opinion. Mm. But hey, speaking of Sony phones and cameras, and what you were saying about the superior auto, you know, I'm very excited to see more and more phones have a really decent auto HDR mode now.
Oh, yeah.
Because honestly, I used to always like just select HDR manually, and now I'm just leaving them in HDR Plus or full auto HDR, whatever. And I find that, you know, the algorithms have gotten really good now that I can actually trust it to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And that's got me very excited. We haven't talked about the U11, but I think the U11 is a really good example of that. So is the Pixel, of course. But
you know, this is the only time in HTC's in my time at Android Authority, I should say, but you know, with every HTC phone, this is the only time that I've never actually used the HTC phone for that year. I've had little to no time with the U11.
You know, you owe yourself to get a U11 for the camera. It is mind-bogglingly good.
Okay.
It's like every time I'm like, you know, at first I was like, yeah, okay, it's good. It's really good. I'm like, yeah, it's like Galaxy S8 and Pixel good. But then I started using it more and I'm like, no, this is possibly not quite as fast as a Pixel and Galaxy S8 in terms of like startup time and shot-to-shot time. It's close though, but it's not quite as fast. But then it nails low light. Like it's better than the Galaxy S8 and the Pixel in low light. A lot, often, not all the time, because remember, I'm using these in auto HDR, but yeah, I'm impressed. I'm really, really impressed. You should try it out.
Yeah, that's what Lon has been telling me, and he did the review on the U11, and yeah, I mean, it feels weird because I was such a big fan of the 10, and now the U11's coming. It's just sort of passing me by.
Only thing about the that's better on the 10, honestly. I mean, the 10 was a great phone. You're absolutely right. But the only thing, but it's so much 2016 phone. Like it doesn't even compete with today's phones in terms of imaging.
Oh yeah.
It's just the only thing that bugs me about the U11 is the lack of headphone jack. And I went on a big rant about this several times now. But you know, it's one thing to miss a headphone jack, another thing to miss the headphone jack the way they implemented it. And I encourage you to listen to the last episode, I think 5 or 6, because I think it's kind of crazy what they've done. But anyway, check out the U11 because I think as a camera guy, you're gonna love it. You're gonna really enjoy it. And especially after using an Xperia, I think, you know, you're probably right, kind of gotten used to the Xperia now, and you'll probably go back to something that's more suitable for the masses, as it were. You know what I'm saying? Like, and then you'll be like, oh my God, I miss this so much. Because,
I, you know, being able to
nail every photo almost, which is what you can do with the G6 and Galaxy S8 and Pixel and U11, is not something I'm 100% sure you'd be able to get with the Sony. So, yeah.
Well, I remember after using the Xperia for a little while in Taipei and then coming back, I had to give it to Narav for a little while, and I remember he was like messing with it. And he was trying to do like a couple of camera comparisons, or he had the phone and he had it for about a week, and then it was time for me to take it back because I was going to New York for my birthday, which would then add to the review. And I remember laughing because when it arrived, I was actually really excited.
Cool.
I was like, I'm so happy that I have it back now because I have this camera experience is unique compared to the rest.
Yeah.
And I love it.
So quickly tell us before we move on from the Sony, what's the battery life like?
It is not great when you consider all phones. But it's kind of impressive when you consider it's a 4K display. So I got 4 hours SOT on average.
That's not bad for 4K display. Holy crap.
Yeah, exactly. I know that it's probably like downscaling to a certain extent. I understand some of the viewers on the video are like, it's not pumping 4K all the time. I'm like, no, the resolution is always at 4K, but the content being shown is probably at 1080 being upscaled, whatever the case may be.
Yeah, but the upscaling takes battery. That doesn't magically happen, guys.
Yeah, that's true. It's not free. Yeah, exactly. So, the semantics are pretty odd. And as we remember from the Xperia X or the Z5 Premium when the 4K display was first introduced, explaining how exactly to take advantage of that display is kind of difficult. So with the XZ Premium, just know you're getting 4K at all. You're getting 4, all of those pixels are being used. So. Yeah.
Well, it's the same with the Galaxy S8. When you get the Galaxy S8 in 1080p mode, all the pixels are being used. It's just that they upscale everything to 1080p in hardware. There's like a hardware upscaler that still uses batteries. It still takes something to make it happen.
Exactly.
But the difference is that when it renders the game that you're playing, it doesn't have to render the game at 1440. It renders it at 1080. So you get a lot of economies of scale because rendering is more expensive than upscaling.
Yes.
That is why you see an improvement in battery life. But do you actually see a difference? My eyes aren't good enough. I've been running my Galaxy S8 at 1080p the whole time I've had it because, honestly, it's just fine. It's just fine.
Yeah, it is. What is it? FHD plus is what they call it because of the aspect ratio. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I haven't had that problem, to be honest.
And same with the OnePlus 5. Like, I'm perfectly happy with 1080p. Honestly, it doesn't matter to me. I understand if you want to do VR, that's an issue for sure. But that's the only time, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So let's talk quickly about a couple of things that, because we don't have a lot of time left, but I want to talk about your Kiwan addiction, if I can call it that. I don't think it's an addiction.
Oh, you can totally call it an addiction. There's a reason why.
So you're still using that Kiwan. I was for quite a while. Like, I'd use it for about a month, but I just honestly, I found that I couldn't get used to the hardware keyboard. Like, I love the shortcuts and everything, but in terms of typing, I'm still faster on an on-screen by quite a bit.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm much faster. Like, put me on a flexi keyboard and I will smoke anybody. Like, that's just me on an on-screen keyboard. But for me, like, there's a certain, I think it was Edgar who said this, and shout out to Edgar Cervantes, one of my colleagues. He was like, it's not about speed on a BlackBerry. It's about writing with conviction. And I was like, yes, that's exactly how I feel. Like, when I type, I know I'm typing the right stuff.
It's true. There is that. And I think that the implementations of the UI with the shortcuts on every key, you're right. There's so many, it's such a fast phone to navigate and get around to things. It's definitely a productivity workhorse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if I could get over the hardware keyboard, like being fast at typing on the hardware keyboard, as fast as I am on a Galaxy S8 software keyboard, I would probably be really into the Kiwan. But I have to say, the Kiwan made me smile every time I used it, every time I picked it up. It's just so good all around. And the price is right for what you get. At first, when it was announced, I was like, ooh, that's a little pricey for what I'm seeing on paper. But then you have to touch it and use it. And then all that melts away. You realize this is such a unique proposition, so well put together and implemented. Kudos to TCL for making it happen.
Absolutely. And you can use the word BlackBerry addiction because there's a reason why. I am actually using an S8 right now as a daily. I just decided to over the last few days. But, and yes, there is some content that will come out of this, but that's not the only reason why I got it. I got that little like keyboard accessory that goes onto the S8.
Oh my God, yeah, that thing.
And I actually use it.
Awesome.
There are only two things about this little keyboard cover that I hate, and I mean hate because I'm so used to the Kiwan. Swiping to delete words, not there. I mean, it's not because, I mean, they can only do so much with this little keyboard cover. And no keyboard shortcuts because, again, they can only do so much.
Right, of course.
But yeah. I'm still finding ways of using a hardware keyboard.
Interesting.
But yeah.
Cool. Well, I like the Kiwan. As I said, it's still one of my favorites. It's not in my pockets just because I got new phones that came along. But that being said, I want to really quickly talk about, I kind of mentioned it a few times, the Moto E4 arrived.
Yes.
I got the Verizon version, which I think cost $70. I think, what is the regular price on the unlocked? I'm not sure. Like 100 and something, 110, 100. I mean, I don't
know.
It'd
be around 100, yeah.
Yeah, look it up. But the point is that it's a phone that is a little bit less than 100, a little more than 100, depending on who you buy it from. And for definitely for a little under 100, I'm like, wow. Like, seriously, wow. It has a fingerprint reader that works well. It has a 720p display. That's definitely not the best display, especially in daylight. But if you in indoors, it's perfectly fine. Snapdragon 425, I want to say.
That was what I was going to ask you. This Snapdragon 425, you really think you could live with that?
Well, at least for just normal UI interactions, it's responsive and fast. I think a lot of it here is Moto's very basic software, right? Like there's no skin here, no animations, no nothing. So it runs really well and really fast. And I could be, you know, it's certainly not gonna, like, if I don't play games much, but I'm sure if I did, I'd be frustrated. It seems to handle my normal day-to-day use. It's got 2 gigs of RAM, and I tend to delete, like, not delete, but kill my apps as I go, so it's fine. I'm just amazed that this phone, to me, basically, if you look at the specs, is like the original Moto G.
Yeah.
Right?
Very true.
2 gigs of RAM, Snapdragon 400 series. I think the camera on the original G was worse, actually. This has an 8-megapixel autofocus camera that's okay. And the original G had a 5-megapixel. So the second gen G had an 8-megapixel. So there you go. It's almost like a second gen G. And I think actually that makes sense because the first gen G had a 4.5-inch display and the second gen has had a 5-inch. So this is a second gen Moto G, essentially, for $70.
Yeah.
You cannot go wrong, guys. You cannot go wrong.
That price is pretty ridiculous. I'm not going to lie. Those are Cricket prices.
Those are insane. It's like 16 gigs of storage, right? So you're going to say like bare minimum. But guess what? It has micro SD. So you can actually use it out of the box for a few days before you say, okay, I should really put my music on an SD card, right? Mm-hmm. But just to shoot some videos and photos with a built-in camera, you're not going to fill out that 16 gigs in quite a while. It's only if you start putting lots of stuff like music and videos, and then you just get an SD card. Look, I mean, it doesn't have NFC, right? It doesn't have a fingerprint reader. So if it had NFC, you could do Android Pay. I'm just blown away that it's $70 on Verizon. It's like, wow. And it has a removable battery for those of you who love removable batteries.
Yeah.
And it's 2800 milliamp hour for a Snapdragon 425. It lasts forever. I mean, it's not like Moto Z Play forever, but it's pretty damn good. It's like at least as good as any of the modern flagships in terms of battery life.
$70 for Verizon's LTE network, that's
not bad either, right?
That is not bad at all.
I know. That's why I'm like telling you, like, this, there is something to be said about this. I'm kind of blown away. When they said you want one, I was like, ugh, fine, I'll take one because I need to experience what it's like. You know, as reviewers playing with flagships every day, we need to play with low-end phones from time to time.
Yeah, no, we are so
because
spoiled.
The reality is so many people can only afford these, you know, prepaid plan phones that are generally kind of crap. And so I wanted to make sure that Moto still had, you know, this awesomeness, and they do. Like, I can tell you, like, I can't think of another phone that I've played with that was a low-end phone in the last few years that impressed me this much for the money, in the sense that you could live with, I could live with it. Like, it wouldn't be great, but I could live with it. So
yeah, I mean, yeah, $70, you can't beat that.
Verizon's check it out.
Network, you know, just put them, man, that's like gonna be a great little like media streamer.
Totally. And yeah, guys, hotspot support, everything. Like, so, like, it has Wi-Fi 8. Look, it has Wi-Fi AC. Dual band N. So, get what? Dual band N. I'm on 5 gigahertz with a cheap $70 phone on my home network. I don't know of any other phone I've used recently in that price range that has 5 gigahertz support. It's like, did they have to? No, it came with the chipset, of course. But, like, wow, right? I mean, I don't know. It's got so many little things that I'm like, wow, really? They did that for this price? Yeah, it's all plastic, right? Of course. But the other thing is, it's somewhat water resistant. I think those were not Moto's exact words, but
I love that.
What they're saying is that if you like accidentally like use
spilled.
It and like drop it in a puddle or something and pick it up right away, it'll be fine.
Yeah.
And that's also nice, right? Headphone jack, of course. Anyway, that's it. I just don't want to go on about too much. I want to talk to you with you about the wearable stuff. You mentioned something very interesting to me when we were planning this podcast.
Yeah.
Please talk about this hybrid smartwatch you were using.
All right. So I, for my birthday, I decided to treat myself, and I had my eye on this hybrid smartwatch whole like trend that's happening right now, where you have an analog watch made by an analog watch company, so you know you're getting good quality like timepieces in that case, but they have certain features built in that allow you to have some smartness going on. So in the case of mine, I got the new, or I don't really want to say new. It's a recent Skagen hybrid. It's the Jorn or the Jorn, J-O-R-N. There is a version as well for women that has the same capabilities, only it's a little bit smaller. And so the smart stuff. There are three buttons on the side that are programmable, and you are able to program them for a number of different things. Music control, for example. And for me, I have it set to tell me what my step count is, which I'll get to in a second. But what my step count is, music control for play, pause, next, and previous. And then the last button is for triggering the shutter button on the camera. So it's good for like really cool selfies. So open up the camera. Yeah, open up the camera, selfie cam it, put a 3-second timer on there, and then just go walk over to wherever you want to be, and then just hit the button and just pose, and then you're good. And it kind of made me think, weren't smartwatches, okay, we didn't call them smartwatches, we called them like spy watches or something like that. Weren't those cool watches in James Bond and all these other places, wasn't it supposed to be that they were analog watches that had a hidden feature or a hidden capability?
Totally.
That's what they were supposed to be. For whatever reason, we just went way too far down the rabbit hole and we're like, put a screen on your wrist. No, we don't need, now that I have this, we don't need another screen in our lives. Like, we do not. as far as notifications go, though, now, first of all, the vibration motor in here, it's so weak that it wouldn't matter anyway. But what happens is it vibrates and then both of the hands, they move automatically to one of four different colors that are just little dots on the side. And depending on which one it, depending on what you program them to and depending on which one it points to, that's when you know you got a notification from Facebook or whatever I programmed it to be, which is pretty cool to just see the hands of an analog watch move to tell you something. The same thing goes for the step counter. There's a little 0 to 100 on the top left of this watch. And what it'll do is it'll take both of the hands, move to zero, and then move to wherever your step count actually is at. So, like, that to me, I realize that's so much cooler than having an LCD on my wrist that just tries to tell me freaking everything that it tries to tell me. And all of the time that I would spend on like a Gear S3 or on an Android Wear device reading the notification I just got is time that I might as well have just spent looking at my phone where it's more comfortable to look at that damn thing.
Yeah, for sure.
So, I mean,
so that's interesting because you came from you're a pretty hardcore Pebble user, right?
Yes. And
you came from a Pebble 2, I believe.
Yes, my Pebble 2 is actually right. It's actually, I can see it right now. The reason why I actually sprung for the hybrid one, because I still love the Pebble and like what it was meant to do and its fundamentals. The only thing is I started to see reports from people on like the subreddit saying that the thumbnails for apps in the App Store are starting to disappear, which kind of was like, writing on the wall. I think it's time for me to move on. So,
right. Well, you know, that's one of the sad things about Pebble. It's hard to kind of like know how long things will continue working, right?
Exactly.
So for me, I've switched to Android Wear, and I still wear the Huawei Watch, the original Huawei Watch. I don't like the Watch 2.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is that basically I'm just like, Pebble was my go-to, obviously, you know, I worked there at the time. But it's just that I've always felt like the display was subpar. It's great in direct sunlight, but I have really bad eyes and I need more resolution to resolve text and read it properly. Like most of my notifications on Pebble, I would struggle reading, even with setting the settings to large, because I'm most of the time indoor and the contrast ratio isn't very good. And this is purely me. I have really poor contrast ratio resolution with my eyes. So that was always an issue. And as soon as I started using an IPS or OLED-based watch, I immediately found that the increased resolution and the fact that there's a backlight, even in like, you know, normal daylight indoors, like would really help my ability to resolve the writing and see the notifications and all that. So I you know, made the jump to Android Wear after leaving Pebble. Kind of reluctantly, because I do still think Pebble watches were smaller, thinner, lighter, much better battery life, right? Mm. So Moto 360 was my first one, and then I went to the LG Watch Urbane, and that was even better to me than the Moto 360, even though cosmetically I didn't like it as much. But to me, OLED was really a better experience because higher resolution and this ability to be always on without really draining the battery too much.
Yeah,
Then I went to the Huawei Watch when it came out, and that one to me was a combination of the aesthetics of the Moto 360 and the OLED of the LG Watch Urbane and incredible battery life. 2 days is typically what I get still after 2 years on that watch. No problem. And so then when the Watch 2 came out, the Huawei Watch 2 at Mobile World Congress, I was like, oh my God, I can't wait. But then I feel that they screwed it up.
Like, yeah, they regressed a little bit.
I mean, NFC is awesome. I kind of like the idea to be able to do Android Pay with my watch. That's the only feature I want. I didn't care about LTE. I didn't care about having a smaller display. I didn't care about the sporty looks of it. Like, I didn't want a sports watch. The thing I love the Moto 360 and the Huawei, original Huawei watch is that you can wear them with, like, you know, if you want to dress up with something and you can leave them on your wrist, they don't feel out of place. Like, they're very normal looking, larger watches, but they're not like sports watches. And I think there's this kind of thing in the wearable world, which I'm kind of regretting to see happening, which is that everybody's looking at wearables as just a sports accessory now.
Exactly.
Or a fitness
Thank you.
Accessory. And you know what? It sucks. That's not what I'm interested in. I mean, I'm not a very sporty person for sure, but at the same time, and I don't want to take that away from people who are, because I believe that there's definitely a market for that. And I think Garmin addresses this market beautifully. But right now, to be frank, the only other watch I would consider wearing other than my original Huawei watch would be like a Galaxy Gear S3. Because even though it's not Android Wear, it's beautiful, it's small, it's classy looking. There's different variants of it. One of them is, a few of them are classy looking. And I hear lots of great things about everybody who has one and loves it, even though it's not Android Wear and it's a proprietary thing. Yeah. And it's crazy for me to say this because the original Galaxy Gear was such a terrible watch, and it took like at least two or three iterations, just very much like a lot of Samsung products, before they nailed it. But with their, you know, supply chain awesomeness, very much like Huawei's, they were able to pull off these, you know, round OLED displays, super thin watches with good battery life, with great functionality. And unlike you, Joshua, I have to say that having had a smartwatch on my wrist after not wearing a watch for over a decade, by the way. You know, when I joined Pebble, I was wearing my Pebble because I'd reviewed it for Engadget and stuff, and I was on board because I like notification on my wrist. And I hadn't worn a watch in 10 years before that. And now that I have notifications on my wrist, ever since then, I haven't been able to do without it. I love notifications on my wrist, at least filtered and organized somewhat so that I don't get everything on my wrist.
Fair. That's a good point.
That's the only reason I use it. So at that point, I might as well have a display, because for me, it's not really about the time so much. It's about not missing important communications from people that I care about, you know?
I feel like once every hour, I want to say half an hour, but that almost makes me feel sad for myself. I'm already looking at my phone to catch up with whatever was there. And,
true.
You know, I just kind of feel like the point I was going to make earlier was like, maybe I'm going through this sort of like minimalism like phase right now. Like,
you know, and that's fine. Yeah. Like, I don't think there's anything wrong. Like, I really don't think most people need a smartwatch on their wrist at all.
Yeah.
I do believe that there's a good market for what Withings or now Nokia is doing, where, you know, they have basically just step tracking, and now the new version, they have heart rate monitoring, but it's really an analog watch in every other way, and there's no notification, or just maybe a vibrate that you can set for notification. That's perfectly, I think, perfectly acceptable. To me, and it's elegant. It looks like something you could wear with a dress or a suit, right?
Totally.
And to me, that's kind of like ultimately where we need to go for those people who don't care about notifications, because the fitness tracking or even just the health tracking aspects are really useful. And at the same time, telling the time and having a timepiece is very useful. So I think they've done the best at combining the two right now. If you're going to go displayless, I think you should consider that. You know?
Yeah, totally. I'm actually kind of a big proponent of it now, because while having a screen on your wrist means that you can do a lot of really cool things, when you look at it, you think to yourself, it tries to do everything. Meanwhile,
yeah,
it's almost cooler to have something that does, it's unassuming, and then all of a sudden, like, I press a button and the camera goes off, and I'm like, that's cool. That's cool.
It's very true. Well, listen, we should wrap it up. It's been over an hour.
Sure.
Do you want to plug yourself and tell people where they can find your awesome work and also your awesome non-work?
Yeah, that's a great way to put it, actually. Yeah, you can find me at Android Authority, of course, at androidauthority.com, and also all of my videos on the Android Authority YouTube channel. I do dabble in my own stuff, and I'm actually going to be ramping up my production on my personal stuff, and it's called Tech NT, so technology, A-N-D, the drink tea, so tech and tea. And basically it's just going to be a place for me to sort of do a number of different things, tech lifestyle, also some health stuff. I do vlogging. I plan on doing some gaming there. I actually opened up I actually started renting an office just for that very purpose, to be able to have a place where I can just focus and just kill it on both Android Authority and also tech and tea. But other than that, you can always find me if you need to find me across any of the social media networks. I'm mostly an Instagrammer, but you can find me everywhere at JVTechT. Pretty easy to find me. And if you want to just sort of kind of see what I'm up to, maybe you might end up clicking through and subscribing to either channel. Go for it. You can find me on social media. I'm not hard to find.
Indeed. And I just want to say, Josh is an awesome guy to follow, awesome person to have in your lives via YouTube and other social media. So you should definitely follow him and subscribe to his channels. And also his work at Android Authority is very authoritative. Ha ha. See what I did there? No, but look, I seriously mean it. Like, Josh's opinions matter. And I think, you should definitely read his Android related work, because I think he's one of those voices that you cannot miss. You can find me on Twitter at Tankerl without the vowels. That's at TNKGRL. My YouTube channel is youtube.com/MiriamJoire, my legal name spelled out. So that's MyriamJoire. Please subscribe to my channel and watch. I do a lot of unboxing videos, some review videos and stuff. You can find my writings at chipchick.com. That's like a chip, like a computer chip, and a chick, like a small chicken.com. It's a woman-centric tech blog. It's pretty awesome. I do a lot of my big phone reviews there, like the U11 recently and Galaxy S8, G6, Pixel, etc. And of course on Mobile Geeks, when there's a trade show happening, that's generally where my coverage ends up. So follow me, and please subscribe to this podcast, and tell your friends about it, and thanks for being on, Josh.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Always a great time.
All right, bye everyone, and catch you next week.
This has been the Mobile Tech Podcast with Tank Girl, proudly presented by worldpodcasts.com. You can visit us online at mobiletechpodcast.com.